Business is simple. It's just not easy. We focus on three things to help you run and grow your business more easily: talent, sales, and how to scale. This is the Talent, Sales, and Scale Show. Hey everyone, Brian Whittington with this episode of the Talent, Sales, and Scale Show. We have a really interesting topic today, all about pricing, and it's one of the key segments to be able to grow the business profitably. And we have Dan Belkowski from Product Tranquility on with us to talk about how do we segment the business? How do we do a jobs to be done? How do we identify the right pricing? Pretty good topic here to hit. So with that said, welcome, Dan.
Hey, Brian, it's good to be here. Looking forward to our conversation.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, this is a topic that we don't hit too terribly often. However, critically important because, I mean, if you can raise top line revenue through pricing and profitability, that is better than net new sales, and that's better than cost, cutting costs. Nothing drops to the bottom line better than a little bit more profitability in the pricing. So I'm really excited to hear what you have to say.
Exactly. Yeah, as you were talking, the pricing changes often flow directly to the bottom line. So it's one of the easiest ways for, but also most overlooked ways that companies can raise their bottom line.
Yeah. Now, before we really dive into this, I got to ask you this question. So, okay, so what? You're running the show. Why should we listen to you about pricing?
It's a great question. So I started my career actually in the engineering side, building software, and I found myself more and more fascinated with not only the products we were building, but how do those products that we're building actually create value for customers? The company I first started my career with, they used a simple cost plus pricing model. I thought, oh, that's kind of interesting. But as I've grown in my career, I've realized that's suboptimal. My passion took me to go pursue my MBA. There, I got exposed to a bunch of different marketing concepts as well as pricing courses. I found myself very lucky. I realized much later that most MBA courses didn't even have pricing. And during the course of my MBA internship, I got thrown into the pricing world. I was working for a very successful Silicon Valley startup, and they had a problem where they sold through four different channel partners, and one of them wanted to be the sort of low-cost player in the market. Mandated that all their partners have a freemium offering of their product. And so the question on the table of the CEO was, well, we have to do it for our one partner. Should we make freemium product for all of our partners? Gave that project to me as well as several others, but over the course of the summer, did a bunch of research on that monetization model, realized it was a terrible idea, TLDR. I do not recommend freemium to anyone. Often most problems that people raise the specter of freemium can be better solved with a 14 to 30 day free trial. Anyways, that was my first foray into the pricing world. Post grad school, went into the product management, product strategy world. And just because of the idiosyncrasies of my background and experience, I ended up not only working on creating value with the engineering side, but also on a lot of pricing projects. Also, the position at the company I was in, we acquired a lot of other software businesses. So at any one time, I was managing three to four different products that had been independent companies. So got to see a lot of mistakes, lessons learned for what to not do, or do or not do in the product management or pricing world. So had a whole bunch of experience there, and then went off on my own about 2 years ago. And now purely focused on helping companies with pricing and packaging in the B2B SaaS world.
Nice. Now, should this context be all around SaaS? Or my understanding is if the methodology or the mindset can work across the whole entire, product set, if you will?
It's a great question. I often thought that it was could be universally applicable. I think that there is distinctions between industries and business models that distinguish SaaS pricing from other types of pricing. So for example, if you're in the hotel or airline industry, you might use what's called like yield management, which is this whole concept of, as soon as an airplane takes off from the ground, right, that unsold seat is now effectively worthless because the company didn't get any money for it. And so there's entire pricing methodologies and systems for those type of worlds that really don't exist in the SaaS world. Similarly, I would call software as a service, software products, durable goods, versus consumables. So if you're selling Coca-Cola, Pepsi, chocolate bars, deodorant, you've got massive amounts of transactions and those same customers are buying your product week in, week out at the grocery store or wherever. Very different than a software model where you've got, you know, we're talking on Zoom right now. I go buy Zoom today. I'm not going to go buy Zoom next week. And so that changes a lot of the different principles that you can apply to a pricing analysis.
Okay, so really, so yield management would be around inventory. If you're going to have lost inventory, you use it or lose it kind of deal. Transactional model is more commoditized, user-based, CPG kind of companies. And then what you're talking about here then is really more value-based pricing. And so that value-based pricing might be in services industries or SaaS industries or something along those lines. Is that an okay breakdown of the differences?
Yeah, absolutely. And we could talk about, value-based pricing is, what I call pricing orientations. So okay. The three pricing orientations are, cost-based pricing, also known as like market-based pricing. So I have a cost of goods sold. I decide to, I want some target gross margin. So I mark up my price to accommodate that margin. Competition-based pricing, looking at what are their competitors doing in the space, and then pricing at a premium or discount to those competitors. And then value-based pricing, which I believe is the holy grail of pricing, is that third one which you mentioned. And within even the SaaS world, you could apply any one of those three orientations, but definitely I recommend people look at the value-based pricing orientation.
So we'll dive down a little bit more deeply into the value-based. And I guess a couple of questions came off of this from your intro is, one, if pricing can have such a drastic, huge impact on not only the top line, but the bottom line, why do you think that there's not a lot of focus on it? You don't see a lot of people talking about it.
I think it's a matter of comfort. If you're in this management position, I think what you said before, right? I can grow my company through a couple of different ways. One is selling more, so customer acquisition. One is reducing costs. The other is optimizing your pricing. When managers tend to look at those options, it feels like the first two are much more tangible and in their control, and that is not as much black magic voodoo. And so they tend to avoid the pricing discussion. Also, we may get into this later, but pricing is one of these areas where, if I'm making, widgets and I'm the manufacturing manager, right? I have a very controlled span of control over the manufacturing line. And so I'm fully within my rights as a senior manager owning manufacturing to do cost control measures. Mm-hmm. When it comes to price, it tends to be one of these aspects of a business where every functional area of the business is a stakeholder in pricing. And without a pricing owner or a pricing process, it tends to end up at the intersection of important and uncomfortable. And nobody is empowered to make a decision, but everyone has an opinion. So this is another reason the pricing gets ignored, is because every time you touch it, everyone jumps on the bandwagon and has their own point of view. If there's no strong leader that has an understanding of pricing knowledge, it's just, all right, well, I'll go back to my domain where I have full control and I don't need to touch that anymore.
Yeah. So did you call it pricing process?
Correct.
Okay. I'd never consider that. I mean, you think of sales process, operations process, manufacturing process, but I've not considered pricing process. Can you touch on that a little bit? And then we'll dive down on some of these other parts.
Yeah. I think one of the fundamental mistakes that people make is thinking of pricing as sort of a one and done exercise.
Right.
I did it. I touched it. Maybe I don't touch it again for 4 or 5 years, but that's not how anything else in your business operates. If I came from the product management world, working product management and engineering, you're constantly updating your products, shipping new features, increasing the value. Marketing is running different campaigns. Those campaigns change over time. And you can apply that to any functional area of the business. It seems out of touch to think that maybe that pricing would be just one thing that we touch once and never touch again, especially if you think about product managers, product strategy, engineering, always modifying, increasing the value, changing the value of your product, potentially the markets, your segments you're serving. That value is always changing, making sure that you have a pricing process aligned to the change in the value you're delivering seems to make sense.
Okay, so the other question I had written down that goes along with those pricing processes, how much does that pricing process change? And I'll break it down in a couple. One, let's talk about life cycle of your company. So if you're brand new, you're looking at product market fit, trying to figure things out, my sense is you would have a different value-based pricing there than, and maybe it's just because I'm a wimp, right? You're just starting out, you're looking for anything, and you're taking what you can. So I would think that life cycle of the business is going to be a massive influencer of what price to go with.
100%. In the earliest stages of your company, pricing is probably not your most important strategic lever. At the early stages of, a startup where you're just developing your product, you're trying to find your first few customers, even maybe your first 100 or couple hundred customers, the most important thing is, again, that search for product market fit. So right. Are we building something that's actually solving people's problems? Can we build a repeatable acquisition model to get customers in the door and sell to them? Do we understand the value proposition that resonates with that market? I will say, charge something. Do not just give your product away. It's what you want is validated market feedback on that path to product market fit. And when you just give someone a product, I call those people users, not customers, make that distinction. You really, you know, pain, you know, you've got value and price. Value is the pleasure that people get. Price is the pain. If you don't inflict some pain, you're really not getting a clear signal from the market of, are you on track? If you just have a bunch of people using your product for free, it really is a bad signal that you're on the right track. So I definitely recommend charging for something. And then as you scale, those things will change. You've got your acquisition channels. You know, every marketer out there trying to grow companies, I'm sure, is always struggling to find new customers, and you'll tap out different channels, different demographics with your marketing. And so you'll start to see maybe diminishing returns from some of those other growth channels. And that point maybe becomes more pertinent to look at optimizing pricing as well.
So whenever you're looking at your pricing, especially from the life cycle or the startup, one side of that is going to be I guess just thinking out loud here, your exit strategy or your growth path is probably going to have a lot to do with it. So for example, in SaaS world specifically, they might be looking for more users for next round of funding or for a profitable exit. So that might be the top line that they're looking at and not so much the profitability versus somebody that's bootstrapped has to be profitable to keep the business going. So how much do those differences of business model, exit strategy, next level for funding, all of that stuff play into this?
They're all highly related. There's a really good point. Ultimately, with your pricing, what you're doing is trying, your pricing should be focused on maximizing long-term profitability. Okay. And so if you're bootstrapped and you need to make it to next month to make payroll, well, long-term for you might be a month. So what is the pricing I need to make it to next month?
So long-term is relative.
Long-term is relative. The idea is that, you know, to help someone else, you first need to help yourself first. You need to have your mind right. You need to be skillful. You need to be, and profit is the cost of the future. If I don't have profits, my company is not going to be around. So the customers I'm seeking to serve are not going to be successful because, you know, I'm going to go out of business. There, as you mentioned before, though, there may be several different areas where different stakeholders, whether those are, you know, VC or private equity investors or the executives in the firm, may make different pricing strategy decisions dependent upon what they view as the long-term outcomes of the company. Oftentimes you'll hear in technology businesses, well, we're going to, you know, price low to penetrate the market and then land and expand. And then eventually, you know, we'll raise prices. Again, you have to take into account, is that viable? A lot of people land and then they don't expand. So they don't have a viable strategy to actually make that happen. But there can be situations where potentially you price at a discount to your, you know, value or perceived value in order to allow yourself to that option to raise prices at a later stage.
Yeah, because what I find is it's harder to increase the pricing. Right. Nobody likes the price increases, especially whenever they know in a SaaS model, for goodness sakes, you're talking 60, 80% margin on that. So it's not like they're hurting. So it's oftentimes hard for that. And I jotted down the mindset about money too, because so much of this, if you don't have a fixed self-service model, right, where people are just buying on a cart, if you throw salespeople into it, that brings up a whole new dilemma, because so much of that salesperson's mindset is, do they believe the value, which goes to their mindset of, or belief about money? Because not only is this a profitability piece, but from a sales perspective, it gets into your ability as a salesperson, your belief of, as a salesperson about money, and then your belief in the product. Is it, does it actually turn? I mean, this is a pretty darn complicated subject here.
Yeah, 100%. And, you know, sales is definitely a stakeholder. And what happens, you know, is you want to make sure that you understand the value you provide to your customers, because that's ultimately going to give you confidence in the price setting. And so there's an open question. I don't believe that sales should own pricing, because I don't believe that their short-term interests of beating their quarterly quota aligns
with the long-term profit. It's like the fox watching the hen house, as they
say. Yeah, or Dracula being in charge of the blood bank. You've got the problem of, you know, misaligned incentives, but, you know, they are a important stakeholder in the process, and definitely, you know, there's an individual salesperson maybe talking to hundreds of customers or prospects even during the course of a month. So it'd be silly from, you know, the pricing, whoever's responsible for pricing, to ignore the feedback of sales. But you also don't want to end up in this competitive death spiral where you don't have discount policies, you don't have price control that you can align to that long-term goal of the business.
So if you sell, let's say you're bootstrapped a little bit earlier on, is it better to price it at your normal pricing and offer a temporary discount, almost like that 14 to 30 day free trial? That way you have a temporary discount, but you sell it at the regular price. So it's easier to get rid of the discount than it is to go in and raise prices. Is that an approach that's applicable or no?
In that scenario, I'd want to be very cautious about what is the reason we're being driven to have discounts, and what is the situation? Are we in a crisis? Did we just enter COVID in March of 2020 and demand has absolutely collapsed? Because in that situation, discounting customers aren't buying when March 2020 came around because your prices were too high.
Right.
They're not buying because there's massive uncertainty and everyone's hoarding cash. So in those situations, you may actually be entering a price war unintentionally, because not only are you not going to make the volume back because all of your other competitors are cutting prices too. Same, yeah. So you want to be very cautious about understanding what purpose are they serving, and making sure that the company has discount controls, a discount policy, a discount escalation policy. If you're a larger company selling enterprise deals, perhaps a deal desk that can monitor and manage all of those discount policies. But often, you know, I think the advice is for any CEO, if your underlings come to you saying, hey, we need to cut price, your response should be, tell me five other things we could do except cutting price first, and let's look at those. If you're in a crisis situation, you've got, you know, the most marketers will tell you, you know, price is the last thing that you touch. You know, you always want to be looking at value instead. Can we create more value? Are there ways that we can give more products or services for the same price? You know, especially if you're in a software business, say you have a multi-company or multi-product software business where you have, you know, multiple different products, your variable cost to give customers, hey, we'll throw in, you know, product X, even though you're buying product, you know, A for free, your marginal cost to do that is nil, but we're going to maintain our prices. And that way, you know, you've not set a precedent where at post-crisis, you have to rescind, you know, a price change. Because again, as you mentioned before, now customers are going to get acquainted to the new price. You've lowered your pricing integrity. And, you know, a lot of this comes down to making sure that you can keep your entire organization aligned to the value you're creating, your prices aligned to that value, and making sure that customers understand you have integrity. This could go in a lot of different directions, you know, especially if procurement departments find out that you're not set in your pricing integrity, that they could use different tactics against you. But yeah, that would generally be my advice in that area.
Okay, got it. Now, with value-based pricing, can you let's unpack that a little bit? Because like you said earlier, that might be the best way, especially for SaaS or a services company to be able to do that. How do you go about finding the value base? Because I'll allow you to answer that and I'll throw some comments in there.
So the question is, how is value created? So at a fundamental level, most pricing conversations come down to a discussion of value. Price is merely how a buyer and seller divide value in a transaction. This is the foundational economic theory of modern capitalism, is that two people will not engage in a voluntary transaction unless both feel better off for having made the transaction. And so there's value created. So the fundamental question is, where does value creation come from? I like to take a jobs to be done approach. I think you mentioned it in your intro. Jobs to be done is a framework. I didn't come up with it. It has many fathers, Clayton Christensen, Theodore Levitt, Anthony Ulwick, many smart fathers of the jobs to be done theory, but it's a framework that helps us understand, why do customers buy? Why do they bring products into their lives? What I like about this as it pertains to the pricing world, and specifically this value discussion, it focuses on us on the outcome customers are trying to achieve and the struggles they're facing. Ultimately, products match problems, not people. Those problems are stable over time. And the problems people face are within a specific context. So many times in the product management world, we'll talk about, you know, personas, which is, you know, some identity. So me as a 40-year-old male living in Texas with a graduate degree, that doesn't matter as much to why I buy a product as a particular situation. I'm at the gym, I'm at the airport, I'm in a bus. That context defines the situation I'm in and also potential obstacles that are in my way. And your product helps me get over those obstacles and achieve some outcome. So the jobs to be done framework really helps us understand that outcome, and creating that outcome for customers is really where the value is created.
Now, where, okay, so when I'm looking, and I'm taking this, so my context, right, my lens is going to be from a sales perspective. What I typically find is that most people don't know how to put a value on that because they're not really the greatest at creating business cases, right, or to really identify that. And worse yet, it seems like the people buying it don't even know how to put a value on it. So how, when you're working with your people, is there a particular methodology or approach that you take to help them to determine what is the value of this?
I think you made a very good point. And it's very clear in my work that customers don't naturally describe the outcomes that they're trying to achieve. Customers will often, as you're interviewing them about problems, they will talk in terms of solutions. And this is endemic in the product management and user experience research world, where customers are experts in their problems and not the solutions. And so it's the responsibility of the interviewer to extract, you know, those outcomes that they're trying to do by probing deeper and deeper. And so there's a few ways that you can go about it. So at the core, people will ask for something. The big question is, so what? If we give you that, so what happens if that happens? Oh, so, you know, so say, hey, I want to be able to jump higher. Okay, so what? So what? You've jump higher. I want to see farther. Okay, so what if you see farther? And you play that game in a very nice way. In a curious way.
So this is like the five whys, but the what?
Yeah. So what? Well, you know, why is that important? What is that going to do? Where we can eventually get to some sort of economic benefit. Where, go ahead.
Would it be safe to say that you keep doing the so what until you hit a point where you can identify dollars and cents or some type of measurable?
Yeah. So there's one thing I think it'd be helpful to clarify on jobs to be done is there's, you know, so the idea of jobs to be done, it's the name comes from customers have a job they're trying to do, and they're going and hiring a product to do that job. There's three different kinds of jobs that jobs to be done outlines for us. There's functional jobs. This is the task that users want to accomplish. And then there's emotional jobs, and those are split into two subcategories. Personal jobs, which is I want to feel a certain way. I want to feel safe. I want to feel less anxiety, et cetera. And then social jobs. So something that increases my social status. This is how all of the social networks work, by me posting pictures of my vacation or my ski trip, whatever it might be, to raise my status. And so these are different ways where we can outline customer value. And so, you know, a simple functional job may be, you know, I want to go on vacation. I want to have a place to stay when I'm on vacation, right? So it's the task I'm trying to achieve. I want to find a place that fits my budget. I want to find a place where I feel safe, right? So you've got functional jobs, and that last one being an emotional job. And then maybe the social job is, I want to show all my friends how cool my trip was on Instagram, or I want to leave a review for the place I stayed, so my status as I can give back to the community and raise my status as a traveler in that world. So you can get at it through the so what questions. The other way is, as you walk people through these conversations, what you're doing is trying to peel back the timeline. So assuming I'm talking to a customer that's maybe already purchased either my product or a product like mine. What I'm doing is walking them through the timeline of their purchase. What is the sort of the triggers that were agitating them to take action? One thing I think is relevant for your audience and sales folks specifically is there's often two forces that are sort of pulling people to take action, pulling them in the future, and there's forces holding them back. And if we could uncover those, we can go a long way to moving people to make the change in their life. Because oftentimes, as technologists, we tend to focus very much on the functional aspects. But at this point, been a cliche, nobody ever got fired for buying IBM, right? That's a very, you know, emotional reaction where it's like, yes, this other product might functionally be better, but if I go with IBM, my job is not on the line. Yeah. By the way, that was actually an advertising campaign from IBM. Most people don't know that, but it's now stuck in people's minds. They understood this at a core level. So as you go through this journey, right, you can help uncover who were the people involved, what was the decisions to be made, what were the anxieties about, you know, the new solution that, you know, kept people in place. I think I read a statistic recently, you know, when it comes to buying process, I think it's something in the order of like 30% of deals is no purchase. It wasn't that you lost to competitors, but everyone lost, like the person did decide to move forward.
Right.
And because there's often anxieties about what could happen, or there's an attachment to the status quo. If we're thinking about complex or even relatively simple B2B software, oftentimes there's training involved. There's other systems that are integrated with. There's deployment timelines, right? It's like, oh, we had the thing today works. If we buy this new thing, it's going to be 12 months before it's fully deployed and operational. I'll leave that till next year because I don't even want to think about that right now. You know, so there's these attachments to the status quo, the anxiety of what could happen, you know, and then, but there are things that are moving forward. What is the pull of the new solution? And what is the agitation, the problems of the current situation that is causing people to even understand that going forward? And so I think as, you know, sales professionals or marketers, it behooves us to really think about those emotional drivers because, you know, those things are going to exist whether or not we acknowledge them. It's much better if we have thought of them beforehand, have elicited them from other folks who have gone before and can think of ways to address those concerns directly. You know, oftentimes that dragon hiding in the closet is much more scary when it's hiding in the closet. As soon as we shine a light on it, maybe we find it's just a gecko.
Yeah, right. Got it. So, I mean, it's kind of curious, all the things that just came out of that. One, we have to find the trigger events. And two, those trigger events are probably going to come from doing customer interviews, right? Finding out what the world was like. There's a woman, April Dumford, she wrote a book called Obviously Awesome that gets into positioning. Your smile makes me think that you know
it. She's fantastic. The book is excellent. I highly recommend it.
Yeah. So it seems like what you're talking about is through that functional identifying jobs to be done is really laying out all of those alternatives. And then further, stop doing the features and benefits, right? It's salespeople get so stuck and marketing people, and I don't know why in the world we haven't figured this out yet, but you do these features and benefits dumps and you just said, it's not about that. It's uncovering, unpacking what are they trying to do and why is that important to them? And it's whether to feel a certain way or for a sense of accomplishment or, like you said, that social status. And taking those tasks and tying it to that emotional piece. So really, I never thought in the universe that we would be talking about this whenever it comes to pricing.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, when we talk about emotional benefits as well, you know, there's not just anxiety, but also, you know, if I'm selling, for example, some marketing MarTech software, for example, you know, potentially I may have the opportunity, if this thing works really well, I'm going to exceed my goals and I might be up for a promotion or a raise or the next, opportunity might open itself at another company. So oftentimes, you know, we don't think about, you know, what is that person on the other end of the phone? What is their personal goals? Yeah. What are their career goals? And those could be just as powerful motivators as well. I think you do need the features and benefits to a certain extent, but I think if Apple and Steve Jobs taught us anything, you know, it's like, if you could, you don't need to have a laundry list of features and benefits. That was always the joke of the, I'm a Mac, I'm a PC, Microsoft listed 150 benefits on the side of a software package. Apple just had a graphic of a happy, successful, creator. And, I think, obviously both companies have done very well, but, there's definitely a benefit to understanding those higher aspirational goals as well.
Yeah. And from a sales perspective, marketing perspective, you take those features and benefits and tie it into what you said is, how does this solve the problem? I mean, that's really it, right? It's not, hey, can it do this? It's how does it solve the problem? And we know all of that stuff. Okay, so we go into finding all of this, and then how do you put a dollars and cents tying all of that information that we just found? How do we tie that back to a proper pricing?
Yeah, so there's a few different ways to think about value that may be valuable here, pardon the pun. What I think we've been discussing is generally what I'd refer to as like economic value, or what economists might call utility. So there's going to be some change that happens, some efficiency that's gained, some cost savings, some time savings, some revenue generation. That's useful to understand your core value drivers. Those are what turn into, when we talk about, I don't know if we'll get to it in this, but when you get to your packaging, you have this concept of a price metric, which is what are you charging for, the unit that you charge for. So whether that's per seat or per team or per document or per API transaction, making sure that those value drivers align with what you're pricing by, right? So understanding that as customers are getting more value out of the product, you're able to capture a fair value of that, fair amount of that value that you're creating for the customer. Excuse me. And then after economic value, we need to consider, right? We don't exist in a vacuum. So, if I'm selling lemonade and across the street is another lemonade stand, I can't charge $10 for a cup of lemonade when the guy across the street is selling it for $5, because the guy across the street has now set the market price of $5. So unless I have some differentiated value, I don't know, my lemonade cures cancer or improves your eyesight, I don't know what it might be that would necessitate an extra $5. The market has set a reference price of $5. So this is really where it comes to understanding where you fit in the market and your differentiated value. Now, after that, you have what is called your perceived value. Maybe all of that's well and good. You can calculate that. But at the end of the day, a customer's willingness to pay for your product is determined by what their perceived value of your product is. Now, marketers have a lot of control over perceived value, but there are things that they don't have control over. It's very expensive. There's no homo economicus in the world. There's no completely rational economic consumer that is fully aware of every competitive alternative in the marketplace and knows all the pricing and knows all the features and benefits of each one. There are concepts called search costs, where the more I go research a particular purchase, that costs me time and money. So I'm limited as a consumer in understanding what's available. And so, between that, as well as potentially there's, some amount of risk discount, like you say, you could create $1 million worth of value for me, but I'm not sure. I don't know. You mentioned before the concept of free trial. This is where the concept of a free trial can be valuable, because you know, I might read your website and say, this product looks like it could solve my job, but I haven't looked at it. And then you do a free trial and you're like, oh, now I get this realization that the value is actually there, right? But before that, I have a risk discount on the value you say you create. Based upon that, then we can have a conversation about willingness to pay. And this is where most, I think, pricers or most people who think about price, you know, tend to get stuck, right? Without the other areas, which is just, you know, thinking about willingness to pay as if willingness to pay is some universal constant that just exists in the ether. No, it's tied to the value you create, the value you can communicate to your potential customer. And then, you know, the prospect or customer will be able to assess like how much, you know, they'd be willing to pay for your product. But again, marketers do have a control over, you know, do they understand the value you're creating? Are they able to communicate that and change that perceived value for customers?
And wow, there's a lot of complexity here, because as you were talking, I was just thinking through some of the, I forget what you said, but it sparked me to, well, not only is it the market that we have to worry about, not as only is it the competition, but it's also the buyer. And with these buyer groups, we might have 3, 5, 10, 12, 15 different buyers within the buyers group. So it will get to personality, their level of risk tolerance. How much is there competition out there? Is this new? Is this sexy? Is this commoditized? I mean, there's really so much that goes into it. How big of a problem are we really seeing? Is it easy to buy? Because if it's easy to buy, I might be willing to pay more. I mean, there's a lot of complexity into this, isn't there?
Yeah. So you're saying there's a lot of complexity, and I agree. So I understand the complexity. The way I approach it, I've got a sort of a four-part model for SaaS pricing. So ooh, because it can get quite complex. So the way I think about SaaS pricing is you start with understanding your customer segments.
Okay.
The core truth is that your customers are not all alike. Customers are heterogeneous. They have different importance for different value drivers, and thus they will value your product differently. And they also have different competitive alternatives available to them. And I use the jobs to be done view of competitive alternatives, where, you know, many companies are in the SaaS world are competing against, you know, email and spreadsheets, not necessarily the other startup down the road that no one else except you have ever heard of, but, you know, you're in that market every day, so you're well aware of them. So understanding, you know, is it a homegrown solution? Are they doing nothing to solve this problem today? And then if you think about those three items, the segments, the value you create, right, that's different by segment, and the different competitive alternatives, those are the three core inputs to your pricing strategy. So when we get to the concept of pricing strategy, this goes to, and I love April Dunford, and I love her work. She's absolutely fabulous. Understanding who, given our segment in the market, who is it that we're ideally positioned to target and serve? What are the competitive alternatives that those segments are comparing us to? And then how are we going to position ourselves to win against that group? And you know, I look at pricing as a, you know, is a function of positioning, you know, in many ways. You need to understand who is it you're serving? What is the unique, you know, value proposition? Because it may vary per, you know, customer segment. And so understanding that is very critical in finally setting the right pricing and packaging.
Okay. So is that, so I want to make sure I got it. So number one was understanding the customer segments. Was 2, 3, and 4 within there as well?
Yeah. So part one,
just want to make sure.
Yeah, no, 100%. No, part one's understanding your customer segments.
Yep.
Part two is the value you provide, which is going to be different per segment. Part three is your competition, your competitive alternatives.
Okay.
And those three, if you think of those as sort of research inputs, right, those filter then into your overall pricing strategy.
Okay, got it. So it's understand customer segments, what value you're providing, competitive alternatives, and then your pricing strategy.
Correct.
Okay, got it. Well, cool. Well, in looking at this, so let me transition to a couple of rapid fire questions, if you will. In looking at this, if I'm trying to figure out my pricing, what are maybe some biggest challenges that you've seen or biggest mistakes that people make whenever trying to set the price for the first time?
It's a great question. I think when it comes to SaaS pricing, most executives think that what you charge will determine your success. In fact, who and how you charge determines your success. So going back to what I was talking about before, understanding the segment that you're going after, where can we compete and win, is critical. And then when you're thinking about how you're charging, right, we didn't get too far into the packaging discussion, but everything from your pricing metric, your monetization model, so is that subscription or pay as you go or perpetual license, to your potential price fences, to your different offer configurations or bundles. Those have an outsized impact on your success. Everyone, when they think about the pricing world, they immediately think about the price level. Is this $100 user? Is it $110 user? Is it $90 user? Is it $99.95? That question is important, but it's at the end of the process. It's probably the easiest to change, especially if you're in a B2B. You're going to have your discounting, so there's some amount of individualization of prices that individual customers will pay anyway. There's way too much emphasis put on that versus understanding who you're charging and how you're charging.
Now, you said a phrase I hadn't heard of before, pricing fences. Is that just your pricing constraints?
So a price fence is, how do we charge two different customers different amounts for the same product? You see this all the time. If you take the bus, you know, I pay one amount, a student pays another amount, a senior citizen pays another amount. If I go see a movie on the Friday at noon, the matinee, I'm going to pay a different price than I pay at, you know, 6 or 7 p.m. because everyone wants to go see, you know. So those would be a price fence based upon identity, you know, student discount, veterans discount, senior discount, versus a time-based fence, which is the, you know, the matinee version. And then what you most commonly see in the B2B SaaS world is what would be like a volume-based discount. So if I buy one seat of a software license, the price per seat I pay if I buy 100 is going to be less. The product's still the same, but the per unit discount changes. So oftentimes it may also be referred to as the pricing structure. So that'd be the price fence.
Okay, got it. So, and again, to sum that up, the biggest challenge that you see is they don't take enough into account of all of those different constraints, I guess, if you will.
Yeah. So going back to the who, you know, oftentimes folks get very enamored that, you know, they're going to be the next Amazon or next Microsoft, and we're going to sell this product to everyone. That's right. Almost rarely the case. And, you know, I view, you know, pricing is a function of marketing, but the core of marketing is really this segmentation, targeting, and positioning exercise. It's so core to, you know, what you end up pricing. You know, if you know, I'm not in the market for a Lamborghini. So if I go on the car lot and I'm trying to buy a Toyota and the guy's trying to sell me a Lamborghini, well, we're in very different spaces. It can be a very short conversation, right? And there's a whole bunch of aspects of that vehicle that are not at all relevant to me, right? So understanding, you know, who is this for, you know, what are they trying to accomplish, and then making sure that your value proposition supports that particular objective, right? If you're clear on that, you know, the pricing falls out of that, you know, very clearly.
Okay, so in reality, then, it almost gets to crossing the chasm, where I have to get niched down to one particular segment, do well there, and then I can start adding other targets. But really knowing back to that positioning, back to that ICP, back to the targeting, it's really knowing that, being super sure of that, and then from there we can start expanding out. Is that right?
Yeah, I think this brings up a topic that comes up quite often with folks, is be careful of the lessons you learn from Fortune 500 companies. You know, if I'm competing against Google or Amazon or Wells Fargo or, you know, whoever, they didn't get there overnight, right? Now they serve these broad markets because that's, you know, eventually they won out all these other segments, and now they have product portfolios that serve every single one of them. But we look at them in as if they're, you know, minted out of thin air. You know, when Amazon started, all they sold was books. It was the bookstore. Now they're going to own every part of the world economy at some point, I think, in the near future. But they didn't start there, right? Bezos was very clear. He's like, books have this incredibly long tail. You know, I have infinite shelf space on the internet. it's a product that doesn't require cold store. You didn't try to go into groceries right away. You know, Webvan did at that point, and that was a dismal failure. But he made a very clear strategic move on what is the core capabilities of the company, what is the product they're going to sell, and then eventually, you know, they added category by category, and now Amazon is what it is today.
Interesting. Okay, and then how about from best hack, right? So whenever you're looking at pricing, should we look at pricing for, you know, tying it to the theme of the show, talent, sales, and scale? Would we tie pricing into labor costs? Would we tie it into scaling? Would we tie it into sales? If you gave one hack for doing that, what was the one hack that we might look at? Pricing for, let's do it easy for you, scaling the business. How would you look at a hack for pricing to scale the business?
A hack for scaling the business. Well, I think the important thing to understand is that almost every decision in a company involves a pricing decision. So when you hire talent and you decide how much their salary is, you're making a pricing decision. When you're deciding how to sell your product, you're making a pricing decision. When you're engaging in any marketing activity, you're deciding, add inventory to buy, you're making a pricing decision. So pricing is ubiquitous in companies. And so I think that's sort of fundamental, is you really, there's no part of your day in scaling a company where you're not making pricing decisions. As it comes to scale, as I mentioned before, there's really sort of three ways in a subscription business to grow. There's acquisition, there's retention, and there's monetization. And so as folks are potentially tapping out on levers of the first two, I think monetization could be a huge hack because it just is probably getting almost no attention in the business today.
Can you unpack that a little bit whenever you talk about monetization? I know the term, but can you get some context?
Yeah. So when I say monetization, that encapsulates the whole activity of pricing and packaging your products. So, we're going back to the fundamentals of pricing, we're creating, communicating, and then capturing value, right? Create value, communicate, capture value. So the question is, anytime you're looking at capturing that value is a monetization activity.
So in reality, then let's go back to your Apple example, that their monetization is increased because of their packaging, right? It's such a higher value based upon their packaging. Is that kind of what you mean? Is how do we want to present our brand?
So the brand aspect is, I think, slightly tangential, right? So I think branding and positioning can be closely interrelated in that, what is the space that you occupy in your prospect's mind? When you think of Apple, you think of the creative type, the designer, all the things that Steve Jobs put in front of us to make us associate that brand with, that lifestyle, that aspiration. When I think about the pricing specifically, right, there's we touched on this a little bit, right? What is the price position that you're going to enter into the market? So going back to the automotive example, am I the low cost player? Am I the Toyota Corolla? Am I the average market player, the Toyota Camry, or maybe the Tesla Model 3? Am I the premium player, the Tesla Model S, or am I the luxury player, the Tesla Roadster, the Lamborghini, the Ferrari?
Yeah.
And I think those can be explicit decisions that companies can make of where they're going to play. And that, again, is tied all into the overall company strategy.
Okay, got it. And all of that would be the idea of monetization.
Yes, it's pricing is not just one decision. I think that's the key thing here, is that pricing is a set of, or monetization is a interrelated set of decisions that you need to make. And so when I think about a pricing process, there's enough of these decisions over time that you could keep a full-time person busy just iterating through all of these different sets of decisions that they could make.
Yeah, and I would think that it's going to change quite a bit. It might be changing on seasonality, market trends, geopolitical factors like Ukraine going on right now. So, I mean, there's a ton of stuff that could go into this. So back to your point earlier, you said you can't just set and forget it kind of deal. So, well, what should we be doing to understand this stuff a little bit better? What resources might you recommend that we could get as smart as you here, Dan?
So in terms of books, I think the one I recommend to most folks to get acquainted with the pricing space is there's a book called Monetizing Innovation. That's very good. And that's a great place to start. I would say, going back to the topics we covered earlier, really work to understand the customer segments that you serve, and, you know, look past, again, firmographics, look past, you know, is this a, Dan's a 40-year-old living in Texas, to what is the particular context, you know, I'm in, because that's really where value is created. So I think, you know, understanding that is really important to the foundations of the pricing process.
Got it. Love it. Okay. And then, what do you see coming down the price, or down the pike in terms of pricing? What do the future trends hold? Things that you're looking and going, oh my gosh, it's scary, or, hey, finally, what trends do you see?
So I've seen several failed attempts at people trying to do A/B testing of pricing. I don't see that working, especially in B2B markets. The main problem there is you've got folks who are multiple stakeholders involved in a transaction. So imagine, Brian, you're my boss. You've asked me to go evaluate some software. I go take a look at it for a month. I give it a free trial. I come back, say, hey, this things look good. You know, this is what it costs. Here you go. And then, you know, you swivel in your chair and look up on the website and you see an entirely different price from the one I gave you. You go, hey, what's going on here? Right. Or you can imagine on the inside of a business, you got the marketers changing the price on the website. You know, sales guy picks up the phone to call a customer. He doesn't know what price the customer saw. So like all of a sudden you lose all this trust. So I've seen a couple different companies trying to do A/B testing pricing. The other reason it tends not to work is most, especially B2B companies, don't have near enough the traffic on their site to get any sort of statistical significance. Barring all those issues, that's one of the areas where I think, you know, maybe it's not destined for success.
Got it. Okay. Well, hey, I really appreciate it. And this was a heck of a lot more all-encompassing than I was anticipating. I didn't realize how all of these interrelated. So I'm glad that we're able to talk about pricing here. So I guess, Dan, the last question is, who should reach out to you? How should they reach out to you? And why should people reach out to you?
Absolutely. So, you know, at Product Tranquility, we help, you know, high volume B2B SaaS CEOs define pricing and packaging for new products. So if you're looking at building significant new functionality, something that could either be a separate product or a new add-on module, looking at attacking a new customer segment, maybe you've acquired another company or looking to rationalize your pricing. Those are all common reasons why folks reach out. And, you know, I work with companies, you know, anywhere from usually 10 to 50 million in revenue, but you know, I've worked with $15 billion market cap companies and down to, you know, earlier stage startups as well. And I blog regularly on my website at producttranquility.com, all one word, and I try to demystify this world of pricing for other folks who come behind me and don't have to learn it the hard way.
Got it. So you're also on LinkedIn, so we'll be able to tie in his LinkedIn information here so you can reach out to him. So Dan, I really appreciate it. And it just goes to show, as good business leaders, as good salespeople, we really need to understand the whole breadth of business to be able to have the business acumen to do this well, to find out how do you do value-based pricing, because it's not just a feature and benefit dump. It's not a spiral to the bottom, if you will, to get the lowest price. It's all about profitability so we can do more stuff and help communities to thrive through entrepreneurship. So thanks so much, Dan. I really appreciate it. Let's get after it. Reach out to Dan, learn this pricing stuff. Read Monetizing Innovation so you understand it as well. Well, not as well as Dan, but you know, you get the idea. Hey, thanks everyone. Be well. See you next time.